Good morning, everybody. So, in this week's Parsha, Parsha Tzaveh, we learn a lot about all the different clothing, the articles of clothing that the Kohen Gadol had to wear. And the Kohen himself had to wear certain clothing, the Kohen Gadol had to wear different clothing. Just by way of introduction, so that we have an understanding, there are many differences between a Kohen and a Kohen Gadol. A Kohen, one of the major differences in the Beis HaMikdash is that a Kohen only wears four articles of clothing, and a Kohen Gadol wears eight articles of clothing. That will be important for later on in this year. But let's talk today about the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim were one of the, it's a very controversial statement I'm about to say, one of the articles of clothing that were worn by the Kohen Gadol. And the question is whether that was one of the eight that we just mentioned had to be worn, or was it something above and beyond the eight, as we will see as we continue. Why are we discussing the Urim V'Tumim? What relevance does it have to us when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash? So it actually has extreme relevance. What we're going to talk about this morning has extreme relevance to a pretty new phenomenon that we find that the halachic world is really dealing with as we speak. It's an ongoing debate, as they say. It's something that a lot has been written about, but not enough, and it's still being understood. So let's get to an understanding as to what exactly this particular problem is that we're going to discuss. But in order to get to that halacha lemaisa problem, you have to hang on till the end of this year. All that we're going to say is going to be just to give us an understanding as to what the complexity of the question halacha lemaisa actually is. So let's begin with the pasuk in our parsha, Parshas Tetzaveh, where the pasuk tells us, as the Kohen Gadol is putting on all the clothing that he has to wear, all the eight articles of clothing, so we're told, v'nasata el choshen ha-mishpat, so we all know about the choshen, and if you don't know about the choshen, you can look over there at Mr. Levy, where you have the choshen with all the different colors, the breastplate, that's what the Kohen Gadol used to wear on his chest. So you have the choshen, v'nasata el ha-choshen, then you should put into the choshen ha-mishpat, es ha-urim ve'es ha-tumim. It sounds like the urim v'tumim were something separate from the choshen, and it's something that was affixed onto the choshen itself. V'hayu alei v'aron bivo lefnei Hashem, and that should be on the chest, on the heart of Aaron when he comes to atone before Hashem. V'nasa Aaron es mishpat b'nei Yisrael alibo lefnei Hashem tamid. So Aaron is going to wear the choshen, which has the name of all the different shvatim. That is how he reminds himself of all the Jewish people as he's doing his service in the Beis HaMikdash. And then we also have the Urim V'Tumim, which were placed, which were affixed onto the Choshen itself. You look in Parshas Pinchas, and in Parshas Pinchas we're talking about Elazar HaKohen, who took over after his father. Aaron HaKohen used to be the Kohen Gadol, then Elazar took over. V'lefnei Elazar HaKohen Ya'amod. He who has some sort of inquiry, he who has some sort of question, some sort of problem, should stand in front of Elazar, who is the Kohen Gadol, v'sha'alo b'mishpat ha'urim lefnei Hashem. And he should ask his question in front of the Urim V'Tumim. And then what would happen? So as we're told, the Urim V'Tumim would give some sort of response. How that response came about, we'll see in a few minutes. But basically, he who had a major question would come to the Urim V'Tumim, which was placed on the chest of the Kohen Gadol, and he would present his question, and then the Urim V'Tumim would respond. Al piv yetzu v'al piv yavou. If the Jewish community is trying to figure out, should we go out to war or should we not? Should we be on the defensive or on the offensive? Should we go in this direction or that direction? Should we conquer a city? Should we not? All of those questions and many more. Al piv yetzu v'al piv yavou. All of that happened based on the consultation that we did with the Urim V'Tumim. V'chal b'nei Yisrael v'chal ha'edah. So this is what we used to do in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, when we had a major community issue that we were faced with, like the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, for example, if they weren't sure about fighting a war, they would go and consult with the Urim V'Tumim. If they weren't sure, let's say, to be Mosef al Ha'ir, if they decided, you know what, Yerushalayim is too crowded, we need more space in Yerushalayim, you can't just add on to the city, you have to ask the Urim V'Tumim, is this a proper thing to do or not? If you want to add on to the Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara says, if you think the Beis HaMikdash is too crowded, also you have to go and ask the Urim V'Tumim, and the Urim V'Tumim would give the answer. So those are all yes or no questions. Should we go out to war? Yes. Should we go out to war? No. What about when you want to ask the Urim V'Tumim, how much should we extend the Beis HaMikdash, or how many feet should we extend Yerushalayim when we want to do an extension? So those are more complicated questions, but the Urim V'Tumim used to give the responses to all of that. Now the Ramban, as we mentioned I think in the past, many different Rishonim had what they felt was the proper calculation of the 613 mitzvahs. Now the Ramban questions the assumption in the first place, and he says, who said that there are 613 mitzvahs? Maybe there are more, maybe there are less. Who came up with this magical number? But let's assume, argument's sake, that there are 613 mitzvahs. So the Rambam writes what he believes are the 613 mitzvahs. And the Ramban comes along and he says I don't know where you came up with this list. I disagree on 16 or 17. I think they don't belong there. And then he has to come up with 16 or 17 of his own to try to fill in the list and make his own list of 613. One of the things that he claims that the Rambam left out was this mitzvah, that when we have a major communal issue that we're bothered with and we don't know what to do, the mitzvah is to go and consult with the Urim V'Tumim. That's the way the Ramban understands our pasuk in the Parsha. What it means is that this Urim V'Tumim was not just a help center. It wasn't just if you need something and you're not sure what to do, you may as well go to the Urim V'Tumim. No, the Ramban understands it was an actual mitzvah to go and consult with the Urim V'Tumim and to constantly be in consultation with the Urim V'Tumim about the questions that face the Jewish community, which is a very interesting concept that the Ramban understands. That's the same as sitting in sukkah. Right, that's the same as shaking a lulav. You also have a mitzvah to go and ask the Urim V'Tumim when you're bothered with a particular question. Why is it that Aaron HaKohen was given the Urim V'Tumim? So that sounds like a very strange question, because we don't ask why is it that Aaron HaKohen was given all the other articles of clothing. So why should we ask why is it that Aaron was given the Urim V'Tumim? Well, this is a question that the Gemara is bothered with. And the Gemara tells us, Amar Rav Simlai, if you look in the Drashos HaRan in number Gimel, the Ran gives us the whole story. Says the Ran, Amar Rav Simlai, because of the fact that Aaron, when he was told that his brother is going to be the leader of the Jewish people. Now let's remember, who was older? Aaron was older. Moshe is the younger brother. All of a sudden, Moshe is the one who ran away, runs away to Midian, finds himself a wife, gets married. He's totally not involved with the whole situation in Mitzrayim. All of a sudden, Moshe Rabbeinu pops back onto the scene, and he's the leader of the Jewish people. And Moshe is very uncomfortable with it. And he tells the Ribbono Shel Olam, he tells God, it's not fair to my brother Aaron. He's the older brother. He's just as qualified as I am to lead the Jewish people and take them out of Mitzrayim and save them. So why is it that you're giving me this position of leadership? And God says back to him, you have nothing to be concerned about. Trust me, your brother is such a tzaddik, v'racha v'samach b'libo. He's going to hear about the news. He's going to find out when you come back to Mitzrayim to save the Jewish people. He'll be very proud. He'll be very happy. There's not going to be any jealousy involved between your brother Aaron and you, Moshe Rabbeinu. This is what he's told. Says the Gemara, Bischar v'racha v'samach b'libo, because of the fact that Aaron HaKohen was so proud, was so happy that his brother was the one who was chosen to be the leader of the Jewish people, Zacha Aaron l'choshet ha-mishpat alibo. Aaron, therefore, was worthy of getting the choshen. Why? What's the connection? And says the Ran, we generally understand that there's a connection, there's a midah connected midah, it's measure for measure. You do something good, God will pay you back, but in a similar measure to that which you did. So what's the connection between the fact that Aaron HaKohen was so proud of his brother being the leader of the Jewish people and him being rewarded with the Urim V'Tumim? What is that all about? Explains the Ran, we're not going to read it inside, but the Ran explains as follows. Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest Navi. Moshe Rabbeinu was a person who reached Madregas of Nevuah. He reached heights of Nevuah that we've never known and we never will know. That's one of the Yud Gimel Ikari Amunah that we're told, that Nevuah's Moshe Rabbeinu, the prophecy that Moshe Rabbeinu had, was on a different level than the prophecy of any other prophet in our history. So Moshe Rabbeinu had this great revelation that he was always given his prophecies. Aaron HaKohen, by having the Urim V'Tumim, you are now able to see into the future. You are now able to answer questions about things that the rest of the world doesn't know. That is the Midah Kenegan Midah, says the Ran. Aaron, you are proud of your brother. You love the fact that your brother is a Navi, and he's on a level that nobody else is able to reach. You know what I'm going to give you in return? I'm going to give you something that's going to allow you to see into the future. I'm going to give you something which is so above and beyond any human experience. That is the experience of the Urim V'Tumim. And that, says the Ran, is why Aaron is specifically paid back with the Urim V'Tumim, because he was so proud of his brother and there was no jealousy there at all. And then the Medrash continues and tells us, the Drashas HaRan, picking up on this Medrash, explains that not only was Aaron rewarded on his own for the good act that he did, but this is something that went on for generations. Every Kohen Gadol that came after Aaron HaKohen, all of his descendants, were able to be repaid for the unbelievable great chesed that Aaron did in his youth. And I believe when you see something of this nature, it's something to think about. Sometimes we do an act of a mitzvah and we say, well, what's the big deal? It's not so important. It's not so relevant. It's not so consequential. It doesn't really cost me so much. It's not such a big deal. You know what? Look what Aaron HaKohen did. What did it cost him to be proud of his brother? Nothing. How strenuous was it for him to do what he did? Not so bad. He went out to greet his brother. He was happy. He was proud. Who wouldn't be proud that their brother is the leader of the Jewish people? And yet, Aaron HaKohen gets paid back for all of that with the Urim V'Tumim, and not only for himself, he gets paid back for all of his descendants, for all generations that come later on, just because of a small, simple act that he did for his brother. Yes?
How did he get the Urim V'Tumim?
What do you mean?
Where they come from?
So that's what we're about to get to. So let's talk a little bit more, and then we'll get to your question. If it's not answered in 5 minutes, you'll ask me again. So the Urim V'Tumim was an essential part of our experience in the Beis HaMikdash. And what's fascinating is, the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, you look at number Dalid, that there were five different things that were present in the experience of the first Beis HaMikdash that were not around in the second Beis HaMikdash, which is interesting because I would have said, if you don't have these things, you cannot have a functioning Beis HaMikdash. Yet we find that in the second Beis HaMikdash there were five very critical elements that should be necessary for a Beis HaMikdash that were not there, that were not present in the second. So let's see. Says the Gemara, what were those five things? Ve'elu hein. Aron ve'kaporos akruvim, that's all considered as one. The Aron, which housed the Luchos. The Kaporos, which was the cover on top of the Aron. And the Kruvim, which were also situated on top of the Aron as well. All of those were not present in the second Beis HaMikdash. Which you'll say, well then what's the point of a Beis HaMikdash? Right? Isn't the highlight of the Beis HaMikdash to have a Kodesh HaKadoshim, to have a Luchos, to have the Aron? Isn't that what the Beis HaMikdash is all about? So that's a very fascinating point that we find here, that in the second Beis HaMikdash, there were no Luchos, there was no Aron, and no Kruvim. That's something that you see from this Gemara. Number two, what was missing in the second Beis HaMikdash was Eish. What does it mean? There was fire missing? So what we're told is that in the first Beis HaMikdash, there was fire that used to come down from heaven, miraculous fire that used to come down and burn the Karbanos on the Mizbeach. Now, that was not present in the second Beis HaMikdash. It was an incredible miracle, but it was not present in the second Beis HaMikdash. Okay, we can have a functioning Beis HaMikdash without that. Number three, says the Gemara, Shechina. The Shechina wasn't present in the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, what does that mean? Why should we have a Beis HaMikdash if there's no Shechina? Isn't that the point? So another very fascinating point here is that it doesn't mean the Shechina was gone. Just means the degrees, the intensity of the Shechina that used to be there was not there as much in the second Beis HaMikdash. In fact, the Gemara tells us, interestingly enough, the Gemara tells us that when the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, people were so excited. And it says, who was excited? It was the youth that were excited because they had never experienced the Beis HaMikdash in their lives. And the older people who had experienced the first Beis HaMikdash were crying at the very same time as the younger people were rejoicing because they remembered what a real Beis HaMikdash is. And they said, what is this? We don't even have an Aron, we don't have a Kruvim, we don't have Shechina, we don't have the fire. What do we need the Beis HaMikdash for? This is not the same as what it used to be. So it says at the very same time as there was a massive celebration of the Jewish community for building a Beis HaMikdash, there was also a period of mourning for the older people who remembered what an old Beis HaMikdash was like. That was all happening at the very same time because all of this was missing. But now we go further. The Gemara says, Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh was also taken away after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. And finally, Urim V'Tumim. Now, Urim V'Tumim were not present in the second Beis HaMikdash. We have a major problem. As we stated in the beginning, a Kohen has to wear 4 articles of clothing. A Kohen Gadol has to wear 8 articles of clothing. If a Kohen Gadol, let's say on one fine day, Kohen Gadol wants to do service in the Beis HaMikdash and he happens to only have 5 articles of his clothing out of the 8, is he allowed to do his service? No, that's called a Mechusar Begadim. He's Chayiv Misa. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash and do your service and do everything you're supposed to do without wearing all the articles of clothing that you're supposed to be wearing. Well, here the Gemara says, in the whole period of the Bayis Sheni, there were no Urim V'Tumim present. So the Rishonim are bothered. Well, then how did we have a functioning Kohen Gadol if there were no Urim V'Tumim? Fair question? How can you have a Kohen Gadol if he doesn't have all the articles of clothing? And we know if a Kohen Gadol doesn't wear all the articles of clothing that he's supposed to, he's not allowed to do his service. So Tosis right there on the spot says, no, don't take the Gemara literally. What it really means is, Urim V'Tumim Havu. We did have Urim V'Tumim in the second Beis HaMikdash, obviously, because otherwise, how could a Kohen Gadol do what he's supposed to do? Shem Lokein Haya Kohen Gadol Mechusar Begadim, because if not, if we didn't have an Urim V'Tumim, then the Kohen Gadol can't do his job. So that cannot be. It's not feasible to imagine that this Gemara is to be taken literally. What does Tosa suggest? All it means is, El Elohayu Meshivin L'Nishalim Bahem. They were out of service. Didn't work. Even though on the first Beis HaMikdash, every time we had a problem, we would confront the Urim V'Tumim and get our answer. In the second Beis HaMikdash, although the Kohen Gadol wore the Urim V'Tumim, but they were not functioning. And we were not able to receive the answers that we wanted the same way we were able to in the first Beis HaMikdash. So this is what Tosfos understands to be the explanation of that Gemara that says that there were no Urim V'Tumim in the second Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't mean that there were no Urim V'Tumim, just means that they were not functioning as they used to function. Rashi in our Parsha writes clearly that that is not the case. Rashi takes the Gemara literally. Let's see the Rashi in number Hey. This is a Rashi from our Parsha, and just a plug for Rashi on Chumash. Always an important thing to read, because you learn so much from Rashi on Chumash, not only in Halacha, but also in Hashkafa. There's a lot to learn from Rashi. So Rashi writes over here in Parsha Tetzaveh, Uva Migdash Sheni Haya HaChoshen. Says Rashi, in the second Beis HaMikdash we had the Choshen and we had the Urim V'Tumim. She Efshar LeKohen Gadol Lios Mechuser B'Gadim. Because you cannot have a Kohen Gadol who's going to serve without having all of his clothing. Abel Oso Hashem Lo Haya B'Socho. Says Rashi, yes, we had a Choshen, but the Choshen did not have that extra part which was the Urim V'Tumim. Okay, now this is a little complicated. The Kohen Gadol wears the Choshen, the breastplate that has the names of all the Kohanim, of all the Shvatim, of all the tribes. And then he has the Urim V'Tumim. So we seem to have a disagreement here as to whether or not the Urim V'Tumim were present in the second Beis HaMikdash, or were they present and just not functioning. Rashi understands, Urim V'Tumim were not here, gone. Second Beis HaMikdash, no Urim V'Tumim. Tosus understands, Urim V'Tumim were here. Why? Because if not, you cannot have a functioning Kohen Gadol. What's their disagreement about? It seems that the disagreement is, were the Urim V'Tumim a separate entity on their own, above and beyond the eight articles of clothing, or were they just another part of the Choshen itself? Let's say, for example, we live in a time in the Beis HaMikdash, and one of the stones of the Choshen pops out. Right? So do you think the Kohen Gadol could do his job? No, it's an incomplete Choshen. And we're going to have to wait around until we find that stone and we locate it and we put it back into the Choshen in order that the Kohen Gadol can do his job. Well, Tosus understands the same way if a stone is missing, he can't do his job. So too, if the Urim V'Tumim, the insert into the Choshen is missing, he also cannot do his job. Rashi understands that's not the case at all. Rashi understands there's the Choshen, which is the eighth article of clothing of the Kohen Gadol. And outside of that, he was rewarded and given something on top of the Choshen, and that was the Urim V'Tumim. If we don't have a functioning Urim V'Tumim, if they're not present, it doesn't matter. He can go about his job regardless. What's the Rambam's opinion on this matter? Let's see, number Vav. The Rambam weighs in on the issue as well, and the Rambam tells us, Asa b'bayi sheni Urim V'Tumim. So how's the Rambam understanding? Like Tosu said, Asu b'bayi sheni Urim V'Tumim. They did craft, they made an Urim V'Tumim in the second bayi sheni, in the second Beis HaMikdash as well. In order, says the Rambam, Kidei Lahashlim Shmona Begadim, in order that the Kohen Gadol will be able to have all the eight articles of clothing that he needs to serve. Even though they were out of service, and even though we were not able to ask any of our questions to the Urim V'Tumim, but still, the Rambam is of the opinion that the Urim V'Tumim existed in the second Beis HaMikdash. He then repeats this again in Perek Beis, Hilchas Beis HaBechira Halacha Aleph, where he says, V'afa Urim V'Tumim, Shehayu B'Bayisheni, when we had the Urim V'Tumim in the second Beis HaMikdash, Lo hayim eshivin beruach hakodesh, v'lo hayim neshalim behem. We did not consult with the Urim V'Tumim in the Bayis Sheni because they didn't work anymore. V'lo hayim osan osam el lahashlim shmona begadim lekohen gadol kidei shelo yehei mechuser begadim. Says the Rambam, the only reason, even though they weren't functioning, but the only reason why we created the Urim V'Tumim in the Bayis Sheni was because otherwise the Kohen Gadol would not be able to do his job. So you see a fundamental disagreement as to whether or not the Urim V'Tumim were just an add-on to the Choshen, or were they an essential part of the Choshen itself, and without that, you cannot have a functioning Kohen Gadol. Yeah?
What did they look like? What were they made out of?
So let's see in a second. The Ramban basically picks up on your question. He says, well, if we're talking so much about the Urim V'Tumim, what exactly were they, and who made them? Are they the same as, like, you know, you make a Choshen, you make a pants, you make a scarf, you make everything else, a hat for the Kohen Gadol? So the Urim V'Tumim were the same thing? Well, says the Ramban, and this is interesting, if anyone learns Ramban on Chumash, I know that women usually learn Ramban on Chumash much more than men do. It's not a bad thing, it's a great thing. Should all learn from you. But the Ramban says, very often he disagrees with his contemporaries. And sometimes he disagrees in very harsh terms. So here you have the Ramban picks on one of his contemporaries, the Ibn Ezra. And he talks about him like he's a nobody. So let's see what the Ramban writes. That's number Zion on the bottom of the page. Says the Ramban, basically asking your question, what exactly were the Urim V'Tumim? Says the Ramban, V'nasata al-choshen ha-mishpat, Savar Rabbeinu Avram. Who's Rabbeinu Avram? The Ibn Ezra. Avram Ibn Ezra, that was his name. So he's picking on Rabbeinu Avram the Ibn Ezra. Savar Rabbeinu Avram lehischakim. He's a wise guy. He thinks that he's going to give the following interpretation as to what the Urim and Tumim were, and he's wrong, says the Ramban. Bini Urim and Tumim ve'amar, and the Ibn Ezra suggests ki he ma'isa uman kesef izav, that the Urim and Tumim were the work of the craftsman, the same way a craftsman would make any other article of clothing or any other vessel that we need in the Beis Hamikdash, so he would also craft an Urim and Tumim. Simple. The Herech ben Yanam, and the Ibn Ezra goes on to explain as to why exactly, how exactly they were made, ki chashav, because he thinks, Shehem al hatsura sheyasu balei hakochavim ladas machshebes hashoah. The same way we find, not nowadays, but we used to find, people knew all kinds of mystical powers, all kinds of things, and they used to make a kameya, they used to make certain things in order to bring about, to evoke the mystical powers. So the Ibn Ezra says, this is the same thing. They had those people used to come along and create the Urim and Tumim for the Beis HaMikdash. What's the big deal? Says the Ramban, Lo Amar Klum. He doesn't know what he's talking about. That's not really what happened. These were not crafted by a regular craftsman who made everything else in the Beis HaMikdash. He's wrong, says the Ramban. Lo Amar Klum, not only is he wrong, he said nothing. He's wasting his words. Avalheim Kedivei Rashi, says the Ramban, the truth is that what happened here was, like Rashi suggests, Shem HaMefurish Nasan Bin Kifle HaChoshem. What it means is, the sacred Shem HaMefurish, the name of God, was written on the Urim and Tumim, and he goes on and on to suggest that this was not at all created by the craftsman that made everything else. Says the Ramban, when we describe in our parsha, and we say, Vayasas HaChoshem, and we say that you made all the begadim, he made this clothing and that clothing, nowhere does it say, and we also made an Urim Batumim. Why not? Don't we have to create? The answer is because it was just totally miraculous. The whole thing was either made by God or by Moshe Rabbeinu. It was something that was made in a miraculous fashion. It was not something that was natural, like every other article of clothing or any other vessel that we had in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore the Ramban suggests that the Ibn Ezra is totally wrong here, and this was not a Maisa Uman, this was not made by a craftsman at all. This is something that was absolutely miraculous. Because it was miraculous, this is why we have a disagreement in the Gemara in Yuma, where the Gemara is not sure exactly how did the answer come about when a question was posed to the Urim Batumim. How did the answer come about? So, what do we think? What?
Mystical.
So what happened? So the Gemara is not sure exactly what happened. It's a disagreement between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Says the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan is of the opinion, this is very important for the halacha lemaisa that we're going to get to, so pay attention to this part even if you haven't paid attention to anything else. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish have a disagreement. Rabbi Yochanan is of the opinion that, you know what happened? We went to the Urim Batumim and we asked, should we go to war today or not? The Urim Batumim all of a sudden would pop out the letters that said, I guess, I'm just imagining, Cain. What? 1 second. So it would pop out those letters. They would protrude and extend and say, Cain, Chaf Nun, yes. So then we would know, oh, okay, it's time to go to war. And if the answer was no, I guess the letters Lamed Aleph would pop up that would say, not a good idea, don't go to war. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan. Reish Lakish is of the opinion that that's not what happened. Reish Lakish says, not only did the letters protrude, not only did that happen, but they also mitstarfos. The letters even came together. So you didn't even have to figure out what the answer was. If it's a yes or no answer, it's very easy to figure out. But what if the answer is yes, you should extend Yerushalayim another 500 feet? That's a lot of letters, it's a lot of words. It's not so easy to figure out if they're out of order. Says Reish Lakish, what used to happen was, not only did the letters protrude, but the letters even came together to form the words of the answer itself. Now, why is that relevant? We'll see in a few minutes. But basically, what you see is the Gemara has a disagreement as to, obviously it was miraculous, but there's a disagreement as to how exactly the answer came about. Now, I would have thought that the answer came about, I mean, Reish Lakish sounds like a very surprising idea. Reish Lakish says that the letters all came together and everything was such a clear answer. Well, then why do we need a Navi? Why do we need a Kohen Gadol to decipher what it meant? Couldn't any layman just come and read what the Urim and Tumim suggested? So that's a very difficult point. If you assume, like Reish Lakish, that all the letters actually came together and presented the answer the way it's supposed to be given, well then why do we need an extra special individual in the Jewish people to try to figure out what exactly the Urim and Tumim meant to tell us? Isn't it obvious, isn't it clear that you can just read the sentence? So that's an interesting point to think about. With all of this in mind, let's now get to the halachic discussion. And that is the following. We know there's a disagreement between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish whether or not, how exactly the answers came about. Did the answer come about by the letters protruding? Or did the answer come about by the letters not only protruding but actually joining together to formulate a word? Now the question is, what if we have an issue on Shabbos? Shabbos is a time when everybody's off, so we sit around and we're having a big discussion amongst all the people. Should we extend the Beis HaMikdash? Well, we're going to discuss all the pros, all the cons. In the end of the day, we're going to ask the Urim V'Tumim. So we discuss all the issues back and forth. Finally, we go and present our question to the Urim V'Tumim. Oh no, it's Shabbos. What's going to happen? The letters are going to protrude. That's like a malach of kosev. And the question that many Achronim ask is, were they allowed to ask a question of the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos or not? Would they be in violation of a malach of kosev on Shabbos if they pose the question to the Urim V'Tumim? So let's just break it down. If you assume, like Rabbi Yochanan, that all that happened was the letters would protrude, but they didn't actually join together, there is certainly no question at all that there's no malacha happening. Why is that? The reason for that is the following. We have a Gemara Maseches Shabbos, Daf Ayin Gimel, as well as on Kuf Gimel. So it's a Gemara 30 pages apart, but the very same Gemara. Where the Gemara tells us, I forgot to put it on here, but the Gemara tells us, how do you define the malacha of Kosev on Shabbos? What exactly makes a person violate the malach of kosev, of writing on Shabbos? What do you have to do in order to violate that? Says the Gemara, you have to be kosev shtei osios b'Shabbos. You have to write two letters. Why? Because there's no word that's only one letter. So if you just write one letter, we assume you're just scribbling. And scribbling is not called a malachas machshavos. You have to do a constructive act in order to violate a malach on Shabbos. Writing one letter is not a constructive act. You didn't write anything. Only if you write two letters do we assume that you're going to be in violation of the malacha of kosev on Shabbos. Take for example, if I take a marker on Shabbos and I scribble, I'm not in violation of malacha of kosev on Shabbos. Why? Because I didn't make anything constructive. You're just doing something destructive. That's not called a malacha of kosev on Shabbos. So too says the Gemara, if you write only one letter instead of two, you are not in violation of a malacha of kosev. Now, the Rambam extends this a little bit and he says, well, if you have to do a constructive act, what if I do something like roshem? Roshem means if you trace something and now a beautiful picture comes out, what are you going to say? That's not called the malach of kosev on Shabbos? What would he say? Well, it's not two letters, and the only time you can violate is if it's two letters. Says the Rambam, that's ridiculous. You can't say such a thing. Why? Because obviously the point of having two letters is they should do a constructive act. If you're going to do a roshem, if you're going to make a trace of something, then obviously that's also a constructive act. You're creating a picture and you're making something beautiful. So then we would assume that's also a malach of kosev on Shabbos. Because of that, there are those who want to take the Rambam a little bit further and say that if you do a fingerprinting on Shabbos, that's considered a malach of kosev also. Why? Because again, all you're doing is sticking your finger in the dye and now putting it on a piece of paper, but you want that exact picture to be on the piece of paper. The same way the Rambam tells if you would trace something, if you would be roshem, that would be a malach of kosev on Shabbos. Well, so too, if you take your finger and you put it onto the piece of paper with the dye on it, that is also considered a malacha of kosev on Shabbos because you are doing a constructive act. And it has extreme relevance to my family because two out of our three boys are born on Shabbos, interestingly enough. And the Magen Avraham says that on Shabbos, if a person knows that they're going to have to be Mechal Shabbos, you should do whatever you can to minimize the amount of Chil Shabbos possible. Okay, so sometimes it's not so easy. In our community, we're blessed that we have the Hatzalah card that you can give it to the taxi, and they'll charge Hatzalah, and everything is done for you, so it's wonderful. But I was living in Washington Heights at the time. We didn't have such an option, and we were having our child in LIJ. So how do you get from LIJ to... from Washington Heights to LIJ without being Mechal Shabbos, not so easy. So there are those who say, the Chazanish is of the opinion, and the Sefer Hasidim says like this, that you should stay close to the hospital in order that you don't have to be Mechal Shabbos. So again, when you have no children, it's a very easy thing to do. We had no kids at the time, it was our first child. So we stayed near the hospital the last couple of weeks of the ninth month of pregnancy. That's what we did. Someone want to close the door, perhaps? Thank you. So that's what we did, and we were very excited about the fact that it seemed that our son was going to be born on a Shabbos, because look, we gave so much for Shabbos, we went out of our way to spend Shabbos in New Hyde Park, where there was literally nobody living there, and we were spending Shabbos there on the block of the hospital, going out of our way, not to be Mechal Shabbos, and here we're being paid back without any Chil Shabbos involved in our son being born. So we went into the hospital Friday afternoon, and we signed all the papers, we're doing great, no Chil Shabbos, wonderful, baby is born Friday night. Not 1 ounce of Chil Shabbos until they come in with a fingerprint. And they say to my wife, I'm like, no way. This can't be. We made it this far. All of a sudden, you're going to make her violate the malacha that the Rambam says is roshem it can't be. I said, don't do it. Tell them they should do it for you. Tell them you're too exhausted. So I said, tell the nurse to take your finger and do it for you. Well, you'll say, what do you mean? But it's still being done on my body. Okay, but I'm not doing the ksiva. Somebody else is doing it with my hand. Well, that's another shaila that comes up. When you have the machlokas, the shach and the taz, it was a major discussion. It happens to be there was an OBGYN who was there then at the time. It was not so right of him. But he was an OBGYN who was a religious guy who was so excited that he's delivering Rav Schechter's first grandchild from our family. So he texted the whole YU to let them know that Rav Schechter's daughter-in-law is in labor, which is really inappropriate of him. But once he was there and discussing the shaila, I kicked him out of the room that he should go home and light Neres Chanukah. For some reason, he wasn't concerned about that. It was Erev Shabbos Chanukah. But we got into this whole discussion about the fingerprinting. I said, once you're a yeshiva guy and deciding to take the liberty to text everybody that we're having a baby, you may as well also discuss the interesting shiloh with me. So we were talking about this, that the shiloh comes up. Let's say there's a woman who needs to go to the mikvah on Friday night. And as we know, when you go to the mikvah, you have to cut your nails and make sure they're trimmed. So what happens if a woman has to go Friday night and she forgot to cut her nails before Shabbos? Well, you're not allowed to cut your own nails on Shabbos, so what do you do? So there's a big machlokas, the shach and the taz, whether or not I'm allowed to ask a non-Jew to cut the nails for me. What's the disagreement? I'm not doing the malacha. Well, the answer is, yeah, you're not doing the malacha, but the malacha is being done to your body. So maybe even though you're not doing the malacha, if the malacha is being done on you, maybe that's something that you wouldn't be allowed to do even for a tzarach mitzvah. So this is a major discussion. That's basically what we were discussing in the hospital about the shach and the taz and ilchas nida, whether that should apply to this case of roshim or not. In the end, the nurse did it. That was the end of the story. But basically what you see, all this stems from the Rambam, and it comes from the fact that the Rambam extends the halacha that the Gemara says. The Gemara tells us only you're going to violate kosev if you write two letters on Shabbos. And the Rambam says, well, not only two letters, also if you decide to trace something and make a beautiful picture that will also be considered a malacha of kosev on Shabbos. Now, the Gemara says in Shabbos daf kuf dalet amud beis, what if I actually write two letters, but the two letters are like this? One on one page, one on another page. So what would you say? Well, if I put them together, you can read the word, but if I take them apart and put them on two different sides of the room, you have no idea what I tried to write. Or let's say, says the Gemara, let's say I have a different case. I have two walls of a building. Not like this, because here you can see both of them. But what if you have two walls of a building in the opposite direction? I write one letter on one corner and one letter on the other corner. So if I'm standing in a right position, I can read both of them. But if I'm just standing on one side or standing on the other side, I can't see both letters. Well, says the Gemara, you're not going to violate a malach of kosev on Shabbos if you write one letter here and one letter there. Or you write one letter on one piece of paper and one on the other, because that's mechusar kreva. They're not next to each other. So again, you did not do a constructive act. Because most people cannot understand, they cannot decipher what you tried to write. So again, if anyone remembers where we started, we're talking about the Urim and Tumim. We had a disagreement, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan is of the opinion that when you ask the question of the Urim and Tumim, so the Urim and Tumim used to protrude the letters of your answer. But they didn't come together. So according to him, there's no question at all. That's not a malach of kosev on Shabbos. You didn't do anything. The same way if I went to a piece of paper and wrote one letter here and one letter on another piece of paper, that's not a malach of kosev on Shabbos. Well, so too over here, if you have a letter protruding here and a letter protruding over there, and then you have to figure out how to put it together, that's not a malach of kosev on Shabbos. Clear? However, if you assume like Reish Lakish, that not only did the letters protrude, but the letters even came together in order to form a word, and we were able to read that, well, here the question is, how were we allowed to do that on Shabbos? Isn't that a malacha of kosev? That was a long build-up to a very simple question. Yes? Yeah? Oh, so there are two basic approaches that are given. Well, some are of the opinion, you're not allowed to do it. Okay? We don't assume like that. Why do we not assume like that? And the reason is going to be very critical in order to understand our shaila, which we didn't yet get to. There are two answers as to why we assume one is allowed to consult the Urim V'Tumim on Shabbos, and there's no malach of kosev involved in doing that. And based on these two answers is going to be the understanding to our major question, which is extremely relevant to Hilchos Shabbos nowadays. Approach number one goes as follows. We're told, Moshe, I forgot to put it on here, but we're told in the Medrash. Moshe Rabbeinu was told, Hein karvu yamecha lamos. It's time for you to pass from this world. You're not going to live anymore. And he's told that today is his last day. Moshe Rabbeinu sits down, says the Medrash. Kivan sheyada Moshe shehayelo lamus. Once Moshe Rabbeinu found out that it's his time to die, kasav ba'osa hayom yud gimel Torahs. Moshe Rabbeinu sits down on that day and writes 13 Sifrei Torah. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever commissioned the writing of a Sefer Torah. but it takes a very long time to write a Sefer Torah. I think over a year takes a Sofer to write a Sefer Torah. Now Moshe Rabbeinu somehow miraculously wrote 13 Sefer Torah in one day. Amazing. Why did he do that? Yud Beis L'Yud Beis Shvatim. He gave one Sefer Torah, handmade, autographed copy to each of the Shvatim. And he asked them that it's your responsibility to teach your Shevet everything that's written in here. V'achas hi niach ba'aron. And one, he leaves in the Aron Kodesh. Why? Why does he leave one in the Aron Kodesh? Shem yivakesh l'zayif davar. If, let's say, he goes to Shevet Yehuda and he says, you know what, here's your Sefer Torah, autographed copy, Moshe Rabbeinu. This is for you to teach your Shevet everything that's written in it. 50 years pass, all of a sudden there's a new leader of Shevet Yehuda, and he decides, you know what, we're going to play with some of the Psukim and Chumash. I'm going to write my own Sefer Torah, I'm going to pretend this is the one of Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm going to leave out a couple of things here. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, not important, but let's leave that out. Lo yelech Elokim Acherim, forget it, let's serve Avodah Zarah. So he starts taking Psukim out here and there. And he goes to the Jewish people of his Shevet, and he says, look what the Torah says, this is the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, how are we going to disprove what he has done? We're going to say, hey, that sounds strange. I thought we're supposed to believe in God. Can't be that Anochi Hashem Elokecha just disappeared. Can't be that it doesn't apply. You know what? Let's check in the Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu left in the Aron Kodesh, and then we'll decide whether or not this is authentic. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't just give one Sefer Torah to each Shevet. He left one in the Aron in order that they can always check the authenticity of all the other 12 Sefer Torah. So this is what happened. Now the problem is as follows. Anyone ever come to Shul Shabbos Mincha? It's not a question to be embarrassed of, but I assume if you daven at home, you probably do not say Tzidkascha. Is that correct? I don't know why, but I think most people don't say Tzidkascha when they daven at home. If you'll check in the Siddur, Shabbos afternoon, Mincha, after you daven Shmona Esrei, we say Tzidkascha Tzedek Li'olam, a three-line paragraph. Now, what's that all about? Tzidkascha Tzedek Li'olam, it's like a Tzidek Hadin. Tzidek Hadin is what we say when a relative passes away, and we're thankful for the judgment that God gave us, and we believe that everything was proper. So why are we saying Tzidek Hadin on Shabbos? What's that all about? So the Achronim understand the reason why is because Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos afternoon. And because Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos afternoon, every Shabbos we say some sort of like a Kel Mole for Moshe Rabbeinu. The fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is not here, the fact that he died, it's such a critical event. So we say a Kel Mole Shabbos afternoon, we say Tzidkascha Tzedek Li'olam. Not only that, the Ramah tells us, and it's halacha, we violate every single Shabbos in the shul. I'm not sure why. I'm sure there's a good answer. I just don't know why. But the Ramah says, and I'm not accusing, but it's just, it's what to look into. The Ramah says clearly that on Shabbos afternoon between Mincha and Maariv, you're not allowed to have a halacha shir because we're supposed to observe an avelis for Moshe Rabbeinu. So if you'll notice, in almost every other shul in the world, they have a shir on Shabbos afternoon before Mincha. Why? Because the halacha is after Mincha, between Mincha and Maariv, that was the time when Moshe Rabbeinu died, and we're not allowed to have a public shir at the time in halacha. You're allowed to talk about other things, but you're not allowed to talk about halacha because we're supposed to commemorate the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu died. I assume the reason we do it here is because we assume we're going to get many more people who are stuck here once they're here for Mincha, so they're going to stay for Maariv anyway, so they're stuck anyway, so we may as well give the shir. If we have the shir an hour before Mincha, no one's going to show up. I assume that's the reason. Can't imagine that every other shul in the world is such big tzaddikim that they'll show up anyway, but that's the basic approach. I know that my father was once asked to speak at an OU convention many, many years ago, and they had on the schedule that he was going to give a shir in between Mincha and Maariv, and he looked over the schedule and he said, I'm not allowed to give a shir between Mincha and Maariv. The Ramah says he can't. So they said, what are you making up halachas? You're not, like, what do you mean? Not allowed to give a shir? Of course you're going to give a shir. So the only way they can come to an understanding was, they said they're going to go ask Rav Soloveitchik. Now, it's a little bit silly to go ask Rav Soloveitchik something that the Ramah says explicitly. You just look it up and you'll see the Ramah says you're not allowed to do it. Anyway, they went to Rav Soloveitchik, and of course, as he always did, he yelled at them and he said, what are you fools? You don't know what it says in the Ramah? Of course you're not allowed to do it. So they said, well, that's what Rav Schechter said. Of course it's what he said. That's what the Ramah says. So they had to change it that he should give a drasha. So again, you're allowed to have a talk in Hashkafa, you're allowed to have a talk in Musar, all sorts of things. But in halacha, we generally shy away from that because we assume that's the time when Moshe Rabbeinu died. Well, Moshe Rabbeinu died Shabbos afternoon. How does he write 13 Sifrei Torah on Shabbos? How's he allowed to do that? Isn't that a malacha of Kosev? Anyone ever think about this? Isn't that a malacha of Kosev? So how is Moshe Rabbeinu allowed to write the Sifrei Torah on Shabbos? So you'll say, okay, he didn't write them on the last day of his life. He wrote them on Friday. Instead of giving his kids a bath that week, he decided, you know what, it's more important that I should write the Sifrei Torah. But if you take it literally that Moshe Rabbeinu actually wrote 13 Sifrei Torah on the last day of his life, how do you explain how Moshe Rabbeinu did that, if there's a malach of Kosev on Shabbos to write something. Explains the Shalah, and you shouldn't just think the Shalah sometimes is quoted as heebie-jeebie ideas. This is quoted in the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer is one of the most important halachic deciphers of law after the Shulchan Aruch was written. So the Chasam Sofer quotes the Shalah that the way Moshe Rabbeinu did it was Hashbaz HaKomus. What does that mean? He did some sort of necromancy. He figured out how to do something amazing with the pen, and he figured out how to say Hashem Hashem or whatever it was, and all of a sudden the pen just started writing on its own, and it wrote 13 Sifrei Torah. Well, you have to say something like that, because how can a person ever write 13 Sifrei Torah in one day anyway? So Moshe Rabbeinu did some sort of mystical, magical powers, and all of a sudden the pen just started writing 13 Sifrei Torah, and that's why he was not in violation of a Malach of Kosev on Shabbos, because he didn't do it. It was a magical thing that happened. He maybe invoked the magic, but he didn't do it on his own. If nobody sees where we're going, think back to where we started, that's where we're going. We find, not only do we find by Moshe Rabbeinu, but we find this in other contexts as well. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, look at number Ches, says the Gemara, Kuf Aleph Amid Aleph, Lo chashin lechishos nechashim v'akravim b'shabbos. Let's say I have a snake right outside of my house, and I'm very nervous that the snake is going to bite someone, I don't know what to do. But there's a malach of Seidan Shabbos, you're not allowed to trap an animal. So again, if it's pikuach nefesh, so you do what you have to do. If it's not pikuach nefesh, but I'm just nervous, it's going to bite someone, it's going to bother someone. So what do? You can't really trap it with a trap. So what's the answer? Says the Gemara, easy. If you're the kind of person that knows how to say all sorts of mystical things, and all of a sudden the snake is going to be caught, you're allowed to do that on Shabbos. Why, says Rashi? The reason why I'm doing this is because I don't want anyone to get hurt from the snake. What you see is that if I do something magical and it's not the natural way of doing something, that's not called a malacha, even though the same result comes about. Even though if I would go with a snake cage, I don't know what they are, a snake catcher, and I figure out how to get the snake in there, that would be a malacha tzedah, trapping an animal on Shabbos. If I do it through magic, that's not considered a malach on Shabbos because I'm not doing anything. All I did was I invoked some sort of magical power and the thing happened on its own. I had no involvement in that happening at all, and therefore we would assume that's not my malach. There are those who discuss, what if, let's say, I assume we don't know how to do these things, so it's not really relevant anyway, but let's say I'm the kind of person that knows magic, I know mysticism, and now I can go and kill somebody with a Shem Hashem or with a magical power. Is that considered, am I now a rotzeach? Am I now called a murderer? So many say no. I invoke God's name. It's not a right thing to do. You shouldn't go around and kill people, obviously. However, am I really considered a murderer? No. Why? Because I didn't do it. It's really God did it. That's a miracle. So when you think about that being the answer as to why exactly Moshe Rabbeinu was allowed to write the 13th Sefer Torah on Shabbos, that would be a suggestion as to why we would be allowed to ask the Urim V'Tumim a question on Shabbos. What happens? When I present a question to the Urim V'Tumim, the Urim V'Tumim gives an answer, but it has nothing to do with me. Urim V'Tumim just responds to my question, but it's just that I invoked a response that's totally miraculous. And the same way we find in other contexts that if something miraculous happens on Shabbos, that is not called my malacha, even if I was the one that caused it to happen, but it's not that I did it myself, therefore we would assume here as well that that would not be considered a malacha on Shabbos, that would not be a malacha of Kosev, even though the letters are not only protruding, but they're even coming together and spelling a word. That's answer and approach number one. Approach number two, and it's important that you understand the difference between the two approaches because that's the way we're going to understand the next question that we'll get involved with. Approach number two is as follows. We're told in Hilchos Shabbos, Lo Sase Kol Malacha. You are not allowed to perform any malacha on Shabbos. Now, what does it mean you're not allowed to perform? So it means you have to actually do a performance in order to violate the Isser. You have to do something. If you're not actually doing anything, you cannot violate a malach on Shabbos. So take, for example, we have a malach on Shabbos that you're not allowed to trap an animal. What if I have a deer, says the Gemara, that runs into my house? And once I have the deer in the house, I say, hey, that would be an interesting animal to have, but I'm not allowed to trap it. So right now it's in my house, but it's not trapped because the doorway is open. So you're not allowed to close the door because that would be trapping the animal. And you're not allowed to stand in front of the doorway because that's also trapping the animal. Now you're closing up the way for the animal to get out. What happens, says the Gemara, if somebody has a deer in their house and they go and stand in front of the doorway? Okay, so they're in violation of the malacha. And now I come and stand in front of them. And now the first person walks away. So what do you say? Again, an animal runs into my house. I'm not allowed to trap it. Somebody violates the halacha, stands in front of the doorway. He's trapping the animal. Now I stand in front of him. I'm not doing anything. Now he walks away. So I'm ostensibly the one who's now blocking the doorway. But I, originally when I came here, I didn't do anything wrong. It's only now that it turns out this way. The Gemara happens to talk about everything. It's amazing. So, what would he say? The Gemara says, I'm not in violation of a malacha. And the Gemara doesn't explain why. And Rav Soloveitchik explained the reason why is because, how can you tell me I violate lo sasa ka malacha when I didn't do anything? At the time that I actively stood there, I wasn't doing anything wrong. Now it just so turns out that I'm the one who's blocking the doorway, but I didn't do anything. It's like standing there before Shabbos began, and I happened to stand there the whole Shabbos. I'm not in violation of a malacha because I didn't do anything. In order to violate a malacha, you have to do a maisa. You have to do something which is showing that you're actually violating a malacha. And over here, in this case, you're not in violation at all. So again, there's a discussion, let's say, when we had the man in the Midbar. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma that the man was able to taste like anything in the world. It could taste like pizza, like ice cream, like steak, like anything. There's a big question whether or not we were able to have in mind that it should taste like basar b'chalav. Are you allowed to have in mind that it should taste like something treif or not? Major discussion in the Acharonim as well. But what about on Shabbos? What about the man falls on Friday, and I want to have in mind on Shabbos that it should taste like X, Y, and Z? And the Gemara tells us that not only did it taste like the steak, it actually, the whole texture changed to feel like a steak also. It got cooked, it got baked, it got whatever it was, and it turned into something else. And this is a big discussion whether or not one is allowed to think on Shabbos and create some sort of outcome that's going to happen based on my thought process. Or you take, for example, you have on sukkahs, so you have to build a sukkah. But the sukkah has a maximum height that it's allowed to be. Says the Gemara, it's not allowed to be higher than 20 amos. 20 amos, let's say, argument's sake, is 40 feet. What if I built a sukkah, my workers built a sukkah, and it turns out 50 feet high? What am I supposed to do? How am I going to lower it? How am I going to lower it? What? You can't drop the roof, so what do you do? Build a platform. Says the Gemara, you build a platform. What if I don't have enough money to build a platform? What's a very simple way of building a platform without spending the money on building a platform? Says the Gemara, just put things all over the floor, and now the floor will become raised. Even if you don't have a fancy platform, but if you just raise the floor, however you're going to do that now, you're going to limit the airspace in between the top of the sukkah and the bottom of the sukkah. Now, says the Gemara, what if I have in my house 100 mattresses? So I want to put the mattresses out on the floor in order to limit the airspace in between the top of the schach and the bottom floor. Well, says the Gemara, you're not allowed to do that on Yom Tov itself. Why? Why not? What? Because that's makar b'patish, or because you are now destroying, so to speak, the mattress. You're now saying the mattress is now dirt. It's the same thing. So I used to have a mattress, now I'm destroying the mattress and making it into dirt. So says the Gemara, you're not allowed to do that on Shabbos or Yom Tov itself. Now, says the Gemara, what if I did it on Friday? I knew what I was doing. I went on Friday, I put the mattresses out all over the floor of the sukkah, and now the sukkah is not going to be 20 amos. But the problem was I forgot to say that I want these to now be buttled to the ground. I want these to now be integrated with the ground, and they should be the new floor level of the sukkah. So I already put them down on Friday. But am I allowed to have in mind on Shabbos, without doing the act, am I allowed to have in mind on Shabbos that these should now be a part of the floor of the sukkah and no longer mattresses? What? It is necessary. It is necessary. So generally you're supposed to do that on Friday. What?
The act itself.
No. So the act itself we assume is not good enough. You have to actually designate it to be like the floor. So can I have that in mind on Shabbos? Even though I did the act on Friday, can I have that in mind on Shabbos that I now want this to be designated as a new layer of floor? So this is a suffix in Rabbi Kivega. Rabbeinu Manoach, one of the Rishonim, writes that it's permissible. Why? Because you cannot violate a malacha. How are you going to say lo sasa ka malacha? What did you do? I didn't do anything. The whole act was done on Friday. All that's missing is my das, my machshava, my mind. So start thinking on Shabbos. What's wrong with that? You cannot say that you violate a malacha just by thinking or by speaking. That's not a violation of a malacha at all. That's not called a malacha. You're not actively doing anything to consider that a malacha. And therefore, over here as well, when you go and present a question to the Urim V'Tumim, answer number one as to why you're allowed to do it is because it was a miraculous nature of the answer that came about. Answer number two is, not because it's miraculous, that's not the reason it's permissible, but rather because you didn't actually do anything. That's not a maisa. Ah, you're talking to it, you're thinking about it, and it's giving you a response. That's not called a maisa to violate a malach on Shabbos. How is this relevant? It's relevant in a very important way. Because you look at this last part of the source sheet, we have a new technology called brain-computer interface. It's called BCI, and there's a lot written about it, but it's fascinating. Let's just read a little bit. You can read the rest later. BCI is essentially a direct communication pathway between one's brain and an external device. Okay, so it connects a person's brain with an external device. By placing electrodes either on the scalp or on the gray matter of the brain itself, scientists are now able to detect signals and interpret what function or movement they were destined to generate. Thus, when I think or intend on clenching my fist, scientists can now direct that electrical energy to an external device like a robotic hand and teach it to clench upon receiving those specific signals. Okay, so that's an amazing accomplishment in science, and so far no shaila. But what about, skip down two paragraphs, games for children are already on the market where one wears a type of electrode cap and plays the game merely by concentrating on that which he or she wishes to accomplish. A mind-controlled car has already been invented and tested, and the scientists who are currently developing this technology say that within 20 to 30 years, people will be able to implant a chip into their brains that gives them the full control over many of the electronic appliances and more with their thoughts alone. Can one wear this cap on Shabbos and play those games? It's not magic. It's not magic. We all understand how it works. But perhaps you'll say, I'm not doing anything. All I'm doing is thinking. What's wrong with thinking on Shabbos? I'm not allowed to think about anything? That's not called osasa kamalacha. That's not a violation of a malacha. And basically, where all the rabbinic literature that comes out nowadays about this very issue, and there's so much that's written about it because it's such a complex and complicated issue, all of it stems from the question by the Urim Vetumim. Are we allowed to pose a question to the Urim Vetumim on Shabbos or not? Well, if you assume that the reason why we're allowed to is because everything that came about was miraculous in its very nature, well, then we have no reason to assume that this is permissible because this is not miraculous. This is natural. We understand how this works. If you assume the reason why we're allowed to ask the Urim Vetumim a question on Shabbos is because I'm not actively doing anything, it's happening on its own, all I'm doing is thinking, and that's not called osasa kamalacha, well then you translate that into this situation and you'll say, that's the same thing. All I'm doing is thinking. That's like having the mattresses on the floor of the sukkah and all you're doing is thinking that you want them to now become a new layer of ground of the sukkah. That's not a violation of a malacha on Shabbos. And this is an incredibly relevant issue nowadays as to whether or not we should assume that these kinds of things are going to be considered a malach on Shabbos or not. You take, for example, the Nest that a lot of people have in their homes, and this is a question I think I get more than anything else. A lot of people install the Nest in their houses. This is a major, major problem for Shabbos. Why? Because every time you walk into the room, the Nest, right? Everybody knows what it is? No? The Nest is basically a system that, if I understand it correctly, it gauges the amount of heat that is in the room at the time. Let's say you set it, you want it to be 71, 72, something like that, right? Correct? It's a thermostat that basically goes, it detects the temperature in the room at that time based on the people that are in there. So the Nest is a major problem. A lot of people have the Nest here. It's a major problem. I don't go to their homes. It's a major problem because you are creating the malacha. And you can't say that I'm not actively doing anything. You are actively doing anything. By walking into the room, you are now activating the system. The same way if you have a video camera by your home, that's also a major problem. If you have a video camera outside of your house, and every time you walk by, it's videoing you. So for somebody else, you say, it's a psikreshet lo nichale. I don't care. I don't want it. I'm the innocent bystander who's walking by the house. I don't need it. But you who own the house, you do need it. You do want it. You are interested that it should take videos of everybody who's walking by the house in order that if someone breaks in, you'll be able to see who it is. So for you, it's a major malacha on Shabbos to have a video camera running outside your house. That's a malacha of kosev. That's a major shaila. The same way a Nest is a major shaila, because by walking, you are in violation of a malacha because you know that you're activating a system. Over here, let's say we would figure out a way to put, instead of the Nest, you would figure out a way to put this hat on your head with the electrodes, and now you'll be able to activate all the systems in your house. Is that something we would allow on Shabbos or not? This is a very active sugya. It's a major discussion that's going on as we speak. And it's something that I think a lot is going to be written about in the future because it has extreme relevance. And as our world continues to develop, it's going to become more and more relevant with many, many different opportunities of shilas that will come up. Yes?